Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. The Utah legislature cuts income taxes, targets courts, and kills controversial bills during the 2026 session. Utah will sell part of the Great Salt Lake to the feds, a deal lawmakers call a win-win for the lake. And it was this program or bust. The federal government upends one of Cache Valley's biggest tools for affordable home ownership. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert Gerke, thank you.
Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Water and land use reporter Leah Larson is with us. Leah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. And Utah Public Radio, Salt Lake Tribune, Cache Valley reporter Brock Marchand is with me in studio. Brock, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be here.
Good to have you here. So let's start with Robert. Of course, last Friday, the legislature concluded its 2026 session. But a lot of things don't come out until a couple days later. It's at flurry just before midnight, and we don't know some things. So we want to do a kind of a recap here. So the headline again, Utah legislature cuts income taxes, targets courts, and kills controversial bills. Those are some of the things that that went on. Robert, let's start with the courts. What happened? I guess a lot of those bills passed.
Some of them did, some of them didn't. It was kind of a mixed bag. They obviously they had a big target on their back coming into the session because of some of the rulings on abortion, on redistricting, on transgender athletes, things like that that had gone against the legislature over the past couple of years. Republican lawmakers were pretty fed up with that, and so there was a whole flurry of bills that was introduced to try to remake and perhaps. Sort of shift the courts to maybe something a little bit more favorable to the legislature. The biggest one passed early in the session. It was expanding the Utah Supreme Court, adding two justices there. The application period's closed, so we should be getting nominees for those two positions sometime fairly soon. I mean, they've got to do interviews with the Judicial Nominating Commission and so forth, but this was done, according to the Republican sponsor of it, Senator Chris Wilson, up in your neck of the woods. He had this was being done because he said the Supreme Court was overwhelmed, taking too long to get rulings out. The Chief Justice had said that it actually is probably going to slow down the rulings because having more people isn't necessarily more efficient. It actually adds some hurdles you've got to clear, but. They went ahead and did that anyway. Also added some district judges and two appeals court judges as well. So that's some additional resources that Governor Cox said on the last night he was happy to see the courts receive. They created this new, it started out as a constitutional court, kind of shifted a little bit into what they're calling a three-judge panel. And what this would do is it sets up a new system to hear challenges to state laws passed by the legislature. So if I'm suing the legislature over a law that they passed, the legislature, the governor, or the attorney general can have that case shifted out of the district court, you know, the single judge, and have it go before this three-judge panel. The panel is picked at a random basis from different districts across the state. And the legislature's theory behind that is, well, now we can get more geographic diversity on these issues. So they went ahead and did that. It's already being challenged in court went up to the Supreme Court. There's some filings on it due today, actually. If that is struck down as being unconstitutional, they created this fallback where it's a permanent three-judge court. And they considered that early in the session and then abandoned it because there was criticism that, oh, well, if the state is always going to be a party to this and the state is picking the three judges, it's kind of like picking your own referees for cases that you know you're going to be involved in. So we'll see how that transpires. But as of right now, that one, like I said, is being appealed to the Utah Supreme Court over the challenges to the constitutionality of it. There was a transparency bill that this was a big issue for House Speaker Mike Schultz, who said that the judiciary is the least transparent branch of government. And so what it would do is it would require most judicial proceedings to be recorded and then make it easier for the public to get access to them. Judges are going to have to file a financial disclosure as well. So they, you know, just disclose similar to what the legislators have to file, disclosing their financial interests and so forth. So those were kind of the big ones that did pass. There were other things that would have made it harder for them to be retained allow the legislature to call sort of a snap retention election if there's something that a judge does that they think oversteps his or her judicial authority. So those didn't pass, but you know, it was a big issue for the judiciary, and a lot of it was, you know, and oh, there was also a resolution that was censuring a judge down in Moab for his handling of a case involving some child sexual abuse material. That one passed the House. It was just a House resolution, but it passed unanimously. So, not unanimously, but nearly unanimously, I should say. So those were the big ones affecting the courts.
Just one follow up question on the Constitutional Court, or this 3-judge panel, I guess, as they're calling it. Yeah. An original draft of this would have allowed only the state to take a case directly to that court. Now I think they've changed that.
Correct. Yeah. So after it had passed and the challenges were filed, one of the a big part of the challenges that were filed to it were that only the state is allowed to move a case from the district judge, take it from the district judge and put it in this 3-judge panel. And the plaintiffs in the cases argued that that creates an imbalance, tips the scales in favor of the state. And also, you know, Utah has language in its constitution about open access to courts, and if only one party can do it, they argue that that's violating that provision of the constitution. So they did change that, so now either party can remove the case from the, like, the single district court judge and move it to the 3-judge panel, and they did that basically to kind of shore up their position in this litigation, and so yeah, we'll see how that goes. One kind of interesting thing is that the way it stands right now, this 3-judge panel, the district courts or the state office of the courts was supposed to identify which judges are qualified to handle constitutional cases. And they kind of looked at each other when they were pondering that and said, well, if a judge isn't competent to handle a constitutional case, they shouldn't be a judge. So they just said everybody is. So right now everybody's eligible for that court. And like I mentioned, four of these cases did get moved to the 3-judge panel. The 3 judges have been assigned, and, you know, they're supposedly proceeding on these. But as I said, we're kind of waiting to see what the Supreme Court says about the constitutionality of it.
The state bar criticized much of this action by the legislature, I think.
Yeah, the thinking being that this is an attempt to undermine the independence of the judiciary, as well as they said it's damaging to the public's perception of the independence of the judiciary. If the public sees the courts as something other than neutral arbiters in these cases, then that undermines the confidence in the rulings that they issue. They had pushed back pretty hard on several of these bills, and you know, some of them got changed, watered down a little bit, but still, in terms of the cumulative impact of these bills, it's a pretty profound shift in the way the courts are going to be operated over in the coming years.
Let's move to elections and how elections are operated. President Trump is pushing hard for national adoption of Senator Lee's SAVE Act. What happened on the state level with this?
This was an interesting one to watch because, again, a big issue that House Speaker Mike Schultz was passionate about. Representative Jefferson Burton sponsored a bill that would have done away with sort of universal vote by mail. People still would have received their ballots in the mail, but they would have had to hand deliver them to either their voting polling place or to a drop box. And this one seemed like one where the House and the Senate just weren't communicating very well because it spent a lot of time getting through the House. It got over to the Senate toward the end of the session, and the Senate had real problems with it because it was going to cost more than $7 million, according to the clerks, depending on how long those drop boxes are staffed. But particularly for, you know, voters in rural areas, you maybe have to drive a long ways to the drop box. You know, it just creates this additional layer of bureaucracy or additional obstacles for voters who want to cast their votes by mail. And the Senate didn't see this as being necessarily a problem. And the fix that was being proposed by the House didn't justify the additional obstacles that it would put in front of voters. And so they ended up saying they're going to do a study on this next year and come back and see if there's a way to do it, you know, without driving down voter turnout. They want it as easy as possible for voters to vote. And they think that the system as it is established right now is secure to the point that they didn't see this as being necessary. So a little disconnect, I think, between the House and Senate on this, and we'll see how this goes during the study. But for 2026, people will still be able to vote, cast their ballots by mail.
Governor Cox called this session a landmark session for homelessness. What happened on that front?
Yeah, it was initially Governor Cox had asked for a bunch of money for his for the homeless campus that they were looking at building. But instead, they kind of focused. The legislature decided to put a lot of money into what they call the frequent flyers. Those people who sort of rotate in and out of the system, take up a lot of time, and you know, sometimes they end up in jail, or they just take up a lot of resources. They wanted to focus on those individuals. One of the things that Governor Cox was most pleased with, he said, is that there's now a permanent funding source for some homelessness programs. They put about $17.5 million into it, in ongoing money. So every year it'll be $17.5 million, and requires a local match from local governments to draw down that money. And he said that was a big change. He was pleased with that and the approach that they took on the you know, those who are in and out of the system regularly.
Legislature did another tax cut. This is several years in a row, I believe.
Right. I believe it's the sixth year in a row that they've cut it. It's a small cut, 0.05 basis points. So it's going from, I believe, 4.5% to 4.45%, I believe, on the income tax rate. According to Voices for Utah Children, you know, lower income people will see about $13 a year, middle income probably about $50 a year in you know, net impact on that. Obviously, people who are higher earners are going to be seeing more. But, you know, the legislature says they want to keep chipping away at the income tax rate and keep more of that money in people's pockets. It was a little unclear at the beginning of the session if that was going to fly this session, just because of the Trump tax bill, there had been some reductions in state revenues through that. And they weren't sure they were going to have the money. But when the revenue projections came in, there was enough that they were able to do that. And they did. So, you know, ongoing. And, you know, in an election year, I think you can see the benefit to the legislators going out and campaigning and saying, you know, for 6 years now, we've been cutting your income tax and letting you keep more of your money in your pocket.
Immigration bills, there were several proposed. I'm not sure if any of them passed. One thing that stuck out to me, Robert, in your story, Senate President Stuart Adams mentioned the Utah Compact as a reason for his opposition to some of these bills. I hadn't heard people mention the Utah Compact for a while.
Yeah, the Utah Compact was this agreement that was reached by, you know, various community groups. I'm trying to remember the year off the top of my head, but I don't right now. But it was reaffirmed at the end of Governor Herbert's tenure. The LDS Church, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was a contributor to that, but didn't sign it technically. But that aside, you know, Representative Trevor Lee had a bill that would have restricted a lot of public benefits to people who can't prove their citizenship. And that bill, interestingly, ran into trouble in the House. He tried to amend it into another bill, and there wasn't a senator in the body who would be the co-sponsor for that, be the Senate sponsor. So that ended up dying in kind of a unique way. And when we asked President Adams about why that died, he did say that, you know, that it would undo the Utah Compact. And he said that if you're going to do something like that, you need to have the parties that were that agreed to it, you know, at the table, including the church. And he said that Representative Lee didn't do that, that he didn't get the parties together and discuss it. And so he, you know, that's why he thinks that bill died.
Tell me about LGBTQ plus bills. This is, you know, in your stories, this is another issue several years in a row that legislators have weighed in on.
Yeah. So a few years back, they put a moratorium on gender affirming care for transgender teenagers. And so they could do a study, and the study came back the legislature kind of didn't like the study that they got back. They disagreed with the findings, and so they went ahead and made that moratorium permanent now. For those teens who might already be in treatment, there was an amendment that allows them to continue their treatment. But as it stands right now, if you're a teen who wants to, you know, in consultation with a mental health worker and your parents wants to get the treatment, that will be off limits.
Just very briefly, I want to turn to another story. Here's the headline. Governor Cox rushes to sign a final hour GOP bid to sink Prop 4 signature removal efforts. What did the legislature do?
Right. So this is a bill, as we've talked about several times on the program, I think, this Republican-backed group is trying to repeal Proposition 4 and its ban on partisan gerrymandering, which is how we ended up with these new congressional maps for this election. So they've gathered the signatures, and there's an effort by opponents to get it knocked off of the ballot by getting people to withdraw enough signatures that it pushes them under the required thresholds. What they've been doing is sending forms to people pre-filled with a stamped envelope that people can just sign it, put it in the envelope, and send it to the county clerks. The Republican group has sued over this, said that the 73-cent stamp that is put on those constitutes a bribe, essentially, to get people to remove their signatures. The legislature, in the last hour of the last night of the session, put an amendment on a bill that now it would say that county clerks who receive those forms in a stamped envelope aren't allowed to accept those. They can't be processed. And so, you know, even though these groups spent tens of thousands of dollars paying for these, you know, this prepaid postage, now that is out the window, basically, kind of a setback for their efforts to try to get this off of the ballot. It passed, like I said, on the last hour of the last night is when it was inserted into the bill and passed. Governor Cox signed it within hours of passage, and it took effect immediately. So the clerks now, if they do receive those envelopes, are instructed to kind of set them aside and not process those. So it is going to make it harder. It probably shouldn't matter, frankly, because there's enough of a cushion for this repeal group. But it is something that was a last minute change.
Opponents are obviously saying this is changing the rules mid-game.
And it's kind of hard to argue otherwise, I think, because, you know, the rules have been that, you know, you just need to return a form to your county clerk and they will remove your signature if you changed your mind or think you were deceived into signing it. But this is definitely changing the rules in regards to that. And working on a story about how clerks are handling this, because it does now require them to do something, take additional steps when they're processing these. And it should be noted, I guess, we're close to, maybe as of today, over 7,000 people having removed their signatures so far. So it's not a small chunk of people who have done this, and you know, presumably more. If, for example, you put your removal form in the mail Friday and it didn't get postmarked Friday and it was going to be postmarked Monday, then you're going to be out of luck and they're going to have to come up with another option. If voters want to remove their signatures, they can go in person to their county clerk's office or they can mail it in, but they've just got to pay for their own stamp.
Mm. Robert Gerke, politics reporter, Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
We're going to take a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. When we come back, we'll talk about this story, among others. Utah will sell part of the Great Salt Lake to the feds, a deal lawmakers call a win-win for the lake. We'll be talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson. More following this.
This week, This Old House Radio Hour and Marketplace Morning Report present Building Tomorrow, a special episode exploring how homes are being reimagined for the next 100 years.
We destroy all these buildings, literally burn them down or throw a Category 3 hurricane at them so that we can figure out how to make them better.
That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour.
Tune in Friday morning at 10 and Saturday afternoon at 3 here on UPR.
For St. Patrick's, it's old and new cultural connections of singers, fiddlers, and pickers. From Ireland to rural and urban America. Also New Orleans and other jazz takes on Irish tunes. Plus reels and jigs for dancing and songs about love, immigration, and drinking. On American Roots from PRX.
Tune in Saturday evening at 8 here on UPR.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in next Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you for joining us.
Hey there. How's it going?
It's going great. Going great.
Good.
So I want to get to the Great Salt Lake. Utah plans to sell part of the Great Salt Lake to the feds. The lawmakers are calling it a win-win, but first of all, I want to continue recapping the 2026 legislature. You have a story recapping bills that shaped water policy this session. So let's go through this one. First of all, the water rate hike gets tossed. This was a proposal. I guess it didn't pass.
Yep. It's bills. It's the Friday after the session ended, so we're inundated with bills. But the water rate hike. So this all came to be because lawmakers for the past couple of sessions have been looking at our aging infrastructure. We got a lot of old pipelines, a lot of old treatment plants, and they're all going to need some upgrades. And of course, communities across the state are growing, which means their water demands are growing. So they commissioned a study a couple years ago to assess what our statewide water needs are. And that came out to be around $1.2 billion, which is a lot of money. So where's that money going to come from? Seems like it probably is going to have to come from the water users themselves via rates. So that's what this bill attempted to do. Utahns currently spend about 2% of their, what the federal government calls your modified adjusted gross income, or MAGI. It's some formula developed by the IRS. So Utahns spend about 2% of that on water bills. But the Environmental Protection Agency did their own assessment a couple of years ago on like what's a fair amount of your income to be spent on water needs. And they landed on 4.5% of that modified adjusted gross income. But they said it could be as low as 3% for low income households. So what lawmakers tried to do with this bill, HB 501, was bump up Utah's spending, Utahns spending from 2% of their income to that 3%, that lower threshold identified by EPA. It seems like a reasonable ask. And we've had Great Salt Lake advocates, water advocates for years saying Utahns pay way too little for water, that they really need to up, you know, what they're paying for water so it really reflects the value of what we're getting and that this is a scarce resource. However, a lot of them actually came back and said that they thought this bill was unfair, it could have an undue burden on poorer households. And then a lot of rural lawmakers weren't too psyched on it either. They thought it put a lot of pressure on water providers that only are serving like maybe a dozen to, you know, a few to several dozen customers. It's just like a lot of work for them to have to figure out how to adjust their rates. So it ultimately failed in the final days. So I would expect to see it revive next year because we got to pay for this infrastructure somehow, but we will see what happens.
Some areas in Utah, at least, are welcoming these large new data centers. Representative Coford's HB 76 did pass. What will this now do?
Yeah, so this is all about data centers, and this definitely had my attention. Oh, and I should have said at the top, major thanks to Gerke. He was the boots on the ground, definitely chasing down lawmakers to get, like, comments and to track these bills for me. So this couldn't have been possible without him. So thanks, Gerke. But yes, yeah, so Data centers have definitely been on my radar. They've been on the radar of a lot of people and newsrooms in recent years because of the rise of artificial intelligence. It's just kind of like become a mass consumer good. And so we need all these data centers to compute, do the computing power to facilitate AI. And with that in mind, Representative Jill Coford did put forward this bill, HB 76, which required large data centers to report their water use data. It kind of got tweaked as it moved through both houses, and it's only going to be applicable to new data centers. But I think this would apply to like that those two huge data centers that are planned for Miller County that we've written about. There's also one coming online, it looks like, in Tooele County, just south of I-80 in the Great Salt Lake, that some people are worried about. There's rumblings of another one near Cedar City. And of course, Cedar City is very, very water strapped. The ground in certain areas is starting to sink. So people are very concerned about what the water consumption will be. And you hear over and over from lawmakers that data centers don't use water. They don't use water. And that's not necessarily true. Traditionally, they've used evaporative cooling, which uses a ton of water. The famous case in Utah would be like the National Security Agency data center in Bluffdale. It's probably our oldest data center in this large data center in the state. And they do use quite a bit of water. But it is true that there are newer technologies that are less water intensive, but there's nothing like there's no directive from lawmakers or from the state handed to these data centers that they must use the best available technologies. So this bill will maybe put a little pressure on them. Like if they have to report this information back to the state, maybe it'll be like an incentive of sorts, I suppose, to adopt best technologies. And you're right, that one did pass both houses.
I want to quote from the story here. You say lawmakers have landed on water right leases as their primary strategy for rescuing the Great Salt Lake. They did some more tweaking with this, did they, in the session?
Yeah, they did. And we kind of expected this would come, when the Great Salt Lake hit its first record low in 2021 and then hit another one in 2022, we saw this big, big push in the legislature to overhaul our pioneer era water law, which hadn't seen much change. There's that famous saying that in the West, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. So for years and years and years, no one really dared to touch water law in the state. But with the Great Salt Lake in such dire straits here in the North and the Colorado not doing much better in the South, they really went to work and overhauled our water law. And you're right. One of the big things they landed on to rescue the Great Salt Lake was this idea, like, we'll let the market dictate and we'll allow farmers to lease their water rights to the Great Salt Lake. Not permanently give them up, but lease them to the Great Salt Lake. That way, people can pay money and that creates an incentive for the farmer to maybe like not farm a certain field for a year or maybe get one or two cuttings of alfalfa and then let it go fallow for the rest of the season. And then that water can go to the Great Salt Lake. So great concept on paper, but in the years since it became law, we have not seen hardly any farmers participate. And when I've gone around the state and just talked to them about what's holding them back, you hear all kinds of things, but a big one is that they're a little suspicious of the legislature because there are quite a lot of land developers in the legislature. So they're just like, this is just a ploy to get our farmland and turn it into yet another subdivision. So there were a lot of concerns that way that I heard. And these two bills, one is HB 348, the other is HB 410, kind of fine-tune previous changes to water law to get farmers to uptake a little more in this leasing program. So it creates a statewide leasing program. And if you decide you want to lease your water, it moves your application to the front of the line for the state engineer to review and approve instead of like, she has a backlog every single year. There's thousands of water rights applications, change applications that she has to wade through. So these move those to the front of the line. And importantly, it only allows the farmer to lease water for 2 out of every 5 years. So that kind of like is the state's way of saying, I suppose, that like this is not the state's attempt to permanently take agricultural land out of production. So we'll see if it actually has the intended effect. It did have broad support from the agricultural industry, but whether that translates to the actual farmers working on the ground, we'll see. Should be interesting.
HB 60 is a little wonky. We talked about this a little bit on the program. But I guess the bullet here is that some environmental water watchdogs quoting from your story, think that this will tip the scales away from them.
Yeah, I think this one was probably the most controversial bill of the session, but it passed pretty easily with the Republican supermajority that we have in both chambers. But yeah, a lot of these environmental nonprofits, these water watchdogs, didn't really like this bill because it kind of hems in, and it came at the request of the state engineer, because like I said earlier, she's got thousands of applications that she has to wade through every year with water, new water rights, changes to existing water rights, all kinds of things, now this leasing program. So it kind of hems in the state's definition of what she has to consider when she's considering, quote unquote, the public welfare. Previously, that could have been anything from like recreation access to, you know, if water's not making it to the Great Salt Lake because of this water right, it's going to damage air quality because the lake is turning into a dust source, right? So this kind of reins all that in and says she can only consider, like, if there's another agency, for example, like the Division of Air Quality, leave that to the Division of Air Quality to handle. And let's keep the state engineer just focused on like the task at hand of the water rights approval and whether it's going to affect other water right, like senior water right holders. So state engineer liked it. The state engineer apparently asked for it. But a lot of these water watchdogs are worried that this, the ripple effect of it all is going to mean that they can't protest water rights because, you know, they don't hold their own water rights in that area of, say, that could be impacted if there's like a new well drilled or a new diversion on the stream. If they, you know, if they don't have a water right in the area, it makes it a lot harder for them to file a protest and take the state to court and try to stop new water rights applications. My thought is that this is just one of those bills where it's kind of hard to say what's going to happen until it's implemented and we just see it, the gears start turning. So we'll see if it does have that effect. But yeah, I mean, my heart goes out to the state engineer's office. They have a ton of work with just, you know, a very small staff. So I can kind of see their perspective on this, that they need a way to streamline things.
We're talking with Leah Larson, water and land use reporter. Let's move to this story, at least treat this briefly. Utah will sell part of the Great Salt Lake to the feds. Lawmakers are calling this a win-win. So Utah is selling land to the bird refuge, I believe, right?
Yeah. So this is kind of an interesting twist of a story in that state lawmakers are selling state land to the federal government, when usually what we hear about with spats with the federal government is the state trying to take federal lands and make it state land. So this is the opposite of that. But yes, it dates back many, many decades, basically to the time of statehood, because when all these states in the West became states, they had this agreement with the federal government, with the United States, that any rivers, any lakes that were navigable and used for commerce at the time of statehood, those lands were handed over to the state to manage for the good of the public, what we call the public welfare, the public trust. So the state has an obligation to keep those lake beds, those stream beds accessible to the public. Your listeners may recall like the big controversy over Utah Lake and how lawmakers wanted to sell it to a developer to dredge and turn into islands. And then the state attorney general ultimately found that was unconstitutional because those are state trust lands. You can't sell off state trust lands. Anyway, so Great Salt Lake, same kind of thing. They landed on the, you know, the Great Salt Lake is very interesting and dynamic lake because it's a terminal lake. Water only leaves through evaporation. It's very big and very shallow. So even when it's at a healthy elevation throughout the season, it will kind of wax and wane. Like as runoff comes in the spring, it grows. And then as the summer temperatures heat up, it will evaporate away and shrink. And that cycle just repeats year after year. So they landed on like what they call like this meander line, and anything below that average meander line is state land. Anything above is private, federal, whatever. So flash forward to the 1930s when the federal government established the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge just west of Brigham City, one of the crown jewels of the National Wildlife Refuge Program. You can go there and see like hundreds of species of birds. It's quite amazing. But when they established this refuge, they took on some land that the state felt like should be state land. The federal government shouldn't be occupying it. And they've kind of fought over it for decades. And then in 2000, the year 2000, the federal government and the state government started negotiations. The state kind of implied it was going to sue over this matter. They did sue in 2012, and it's been working its way through the court since then. And then finally, at the 11th hour of the legislature, they apparently struck a deal with the federal government, and the state agreed to sell its state land, its state lake bed, this little portion of the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge, to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Because, you know, you're not going to build a hotel on a swampy bird habitat. So, like, it wasn't really useful land to the state anyway. So the state gets, I think it was $60 million, and they're going to use all that money to benefit the lake. So that's why they're calling it a win-win.
All right. Thanks for telling us about these all of this. Leah Larson with the Tribune. Thank you.
You bet.
We're going to take another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the Weekly News Roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. When we come back, here is the headline we'll be talking about. Hundreds in northern Utah attained home ownership through this housing program. Federal changes have made it virtually useless. We'll be talking with UPR and Tribune Cache Valley reporter Brock Marchant. More following this break.
Hi, this is Nick Forrester. This week it's E-Town on the Road, coming to you from Bentonville, Arkansas, with special musical guests the Milk Carton Kids and Buffalo Nichols, plus a conversation with local hero Nate Wells, and that's all this week in E-Town.
Tune in Saturday evening at 7 here on UPR.
Congratulations to Rehan Bakhtur, winner of the 2026 UPR Art Mug Contest. Right now, you can check out Rehan's winning painting titled UPR Morning to Night at upr.org or on UPR's Facebook or Instagram pages. And then don't forget to tune in during the Spring Fun Drive so you can pick up a mug featuring Rehan's design. Starting March 21st, we'll have those mugs available for $10 a month or more donations. We also want to thank all of the incredibly talented and creative artists who submitted to the contest this year.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the Weekly News Roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We welcome in UPR and Tribune Cache Valley reporter Brock Marchant, who's in studio with me. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I've talked to you several times on the program remotely. You were the emerging news reporter now here in Cache Valley, so it's great to have you in this role.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to be here. It's been great.
You are a Cache Valley native.
I am. Yeah, I'm from Smithfield, actually.
Yeah.
So.
Wonderful. People go check out his your introductory article, your story, where you tell a little bit about yourself. You can check that out at sltrib.com. We want to talk about housing. This is an important story. Hundreds in northern Utah attained home ownership through this housing program. Federal changes have made it virtually useless. You talk about Cache Valley, but I think this affects, people elsewhere in the state and around the country. What program is this?
Yeah, so this is the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Mutual Self-Help Housing Program, and you're exactly right. I did focus on Cache Valley and Box Elder County, but this is going to affect most of Utah, according to the experts I talked to, as well as a lot of states where housing prices are really, really high. This program, it's federally funded, it's implemented on a more local level, and it allows lower-income families and lower-income people to have a path toward owning a home that they otherwise might not have. They have to spend at least 35 hours a week building their houses, as well as neighbors in the program, doing work that they can under the supervision of experts and professionals. And in doing that, they save a lot of the building cost. And then they also are typically able to get a very low mortgage rate through USDA funding. So it allows families who otherwise might be renting for several decades or just in general wouldn't be able to afford a home to get in a home that they build while developing, these construction skills. What has happened and what changed last month is the USDA implemented lower limits on how much those homes can be valued at that they build. And these limits depend on where you live. They depend on general housing costs. In Cache Valley, the new limit to how much a home can be valued at and be appraised for that's built through this program is $324,700. And that's Box Elder County as well. And Josh Runhar, the director of the local program that helps direct this program, said that that number isn't really manageable with the current home market, and that they really can't build much that's worth building while trying to stick with that budget. He just doesn't find it very viable. And this has been their largest tool in helping people in Cache Valley get into homes. It's helped 700 families in Cache and Box Elder County over the past 25 years. So looking toward the future, they're not really sure what's going to happen or what's going to happen with this program. They mentioned that it might still be feasible in places in Utah with much higher costs because that will bring that cap up. But that's like Summit and Wasatch County and so many other areas of the state just kind of lose access to this because they're budgeted too low to get a house up.
Why does the government say they're doing this, making this change?
Yeah, so a USDA spokesperson told me that there's several reasons. A big one that they said is that they're trying to save money to allow more families into this program. So essentially kind of spreading out the funding, allowing more people to enter and to build these homes. They also mentioned that it can help prevent defaults, which end up falling on, you know, the government and the taxpayer. And they mentioned local municipal governments can look into smaller lots and smaller homes. But a big part of it is trying to get more people into the program and trying to spread that funding more.
You talked to several families. One family got in just under the deadline. The other one missed it. Tell me just briefly about these families.
Yeah. So Cameron and Katie Oldham, I think they were not the last group to get approved, but the second to last. And, you know, they're building a home right now in Hiram. I talked with Cameron while he was trying to put shingles on his roof, actually. So they're currently in the process of going through that construction. And he just mentioned how he's a speech pathologist in local schools and how for his family, there was no way it was going to happen. He said it was this program or bust in his words. Like it just, they were not going to be able to get into a home without this assistance and without this self-help program. Justin and Kimberly Stubbs, on the other hand, applied for this program in July of last year. And for months before that, were working to make sure that they would qualify. They had to sell a townhome that they owned at a relatively low interest rate. They'd welcomed some kids and they were looking to expand, get into a home. And they were thinking they would be approved. The federal government shut down, delayed that process, and then they find out last month that their request is no longer viable, that the loan that they asked for is no longer going to be granted under this program. Mm-hmm. So they're living in Kimberly's, you know, mother's home and just kind of stuck at this point. Mm-hmm. They're not sure what the next step is or what to do. They were depending on a program that the rules have just changed.
Is there any recourse, any other programs, anything they can do?
There are some other things, and there are bills currently being discussed on the federal level to help housing construction go through quicker and cheaper. But generally, I mean, this is, according to Runhar, this was the big tool that was being implemented in Cache Valley to help people get into affordable houses. Mm-hmm. So there are other things to do, but nothing that has been as impactful as this program.
Yeah. And this is administered by a neighborhood nonprofit, right? So just anecdotally, just about everybody I know, admittedly small sample size, who has gotten into a house in the last couple of years has got through this program.
Yeah, no, it's definitely.
It's been hugely impactful. Well, we have a couple of minutes. So I want to do as much as we can on this story, and then we'll have you read it. This is talking about St. Anne's Retreat. I noticed St. Anne's Retreat up Logan Canyon. In recent years, it has been a site for teenagers and others, college students to go up and get a thrill. It's supposedly, some say, haunted. So the news is a gentleman has purchased this.
Yeah. Cameron Jensen, he's a Saratoga Springs real estate developer, and he bought the place without knowing that it has so many stories around it about being haunted. He thought, you know, he saw the beautiful craftsmanship. It's on forestry land, but it's right next to Logan River. It's a very beautiful area, and he thought it was a great investment opportunity. He wants to turn it into a functioning resort with several amenities. And it was his wife who was Googling this place and saw all of the really dark rumors that have circulated around Cache Valley for years about what didn't really happen there, but with what people say did. So it's been interesting for him to try to balance restoring this place with those rumors and those stories about hauntings and ghosts and whatever else people like to say happens.
Again, very quickly, we'll have to have you go read the story, but this was for several decades was owned by the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
It was a retreat for nuns in one of the uses, right? And so you talk to a folklorist, there's always, this is ancient, always rumors swirling if you have a place for nuns, I guess.
Yeah. It was first built by a couple of really wealthy families before they donated it to the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City. And at that time, Lisa Gabbert, the director of Utah State University's folklore program, mentioned that there were a lot of unknowns in Cache Valley about the Catholic Church. She mentioned how at that time the Catholic Church was more of a closed-off community, as was Cache Valley. So there was kind of this gap in knowledge of what's happening here. What are nuns? What do they do? And in those gaps, people were able to fill, you know, with these really often dark and fancy, just fantastical tales of what could be happening in the canyon. So it was kind of just a great, I guess, opportunity for those stories to circulate. And they, I mean, they're still, you can hear them in any high school in the canyon or in the valley. They're still popular.
Yeah, certainly. So Cameron Jensen, he's determined he's going to turn this into, a resort again.
Yeah. He wants a Pilates studio. He wants a coffee shop. He wants people to be able to rent the different cabins. There are several there. He's very optimistic to be able to do it pretty quickly. He wants to start opening next year. Where this is a historical site on federal land, he's got different regulations that he kind of has to balance on what he can do and how he can restore things. But yeah, he's excited for the potential of this property.
Well, to learn more, go to the story, Brock Marchand's story in the Tribune. It's time now for, well, thank you, Brock.
Thank
you. Should do that first. It's time for Underplayed Stories of the Week. Let's start with Robert Gerke. What's your underplayed story?
Sorry, I was muted. I usually don't do this, but I'm going to do one of my own stories. I did a piece about Representative Nelson Abbott, who's an Orem Republican, who had a bill this past session that would have, it was aimed at stimulating rural job creation. Toward the end of the legislative session, there was, during the budget bill, he took issue with a $10 million appropriation for the Pioneer Trail, which would be a 1.3-mile walking trail through from the Salt Lake Temple up to the Capitol and down into Memory Grove. He thought that was exorbitant and a waste of taxpayers' money, so he tried to get that stripped out. In retaliation, he says the House Republican leadership ended up killing his jobs bill. And then on the last night of the session, there was a little skit that made fun of him for that. And he took exception to that. He said they were rubbing his nose in it. It kind of just points to the power that Republican leadership has in the legislature and the way that sometimes they're not afraid to use it, even against their own members.
Yeah, interesting story. SLTrib.com for that one. Leah Larson, what's your underplayed story?
So mine just published today, so maybe it won't be that underplayed, but it's by my colleague Brooke Larson. If your listeners remember, the Trump administration gave this directive to federal agencies to not refer to like negative parts of American history at national parks, climate change, things like that. And it's kind of an erasure of some mistreatment to Indigenous and Black Americans, and an erasure of science and a little bit nationalistic. So she wrote about what this means for our national parks here in Utah, and I think it's a fascinating read. So check it out.
SLTrib.com to read that one. Mark Marchin, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, so this is from education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. It's We Ask, You Answered. Here's what Utah educators say are the biggest challenges in schools today. And this is from people currently in schools who answered questions from the Tribune about what teachers are facing and what they have to work through right now. And it's interesting to me to read through and see the biggest problems from the perspective of people who face them daily.
SLTrib.com for that one as well. Appreciate that. Well, you have been listening to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And we've had on with us Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend. Yes, thank you. Water and Land Use reporter Leah Larson has been with us. Leah, thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And UPR and Tribune Cache Valley reporter Brock Marchant has joined us. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Hope you'll be with me again next week.